How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. On this week's show, our correspondent Stuart Richardson discusses the issue of factory farming and diet with Carl Loskin, host of Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio.
What we really feel we want is we want family farms and not factory farms, and a sustainable method that takes into account the emissions of carbon to produce our food.
And Anna Maria Christina reports from the Trout Lake Farmers Market about the benefits of buying local.
We offer the opportunity for people to talk to their farmer and find out how did they grow this, and if they're not certified organic, how do they use pesticides, how do they use fungicides.
Our streeters this week are from the farmers market, where people were talking about why they like going to the market and buying local.
So what brings you to the Vancouver Farmers Market?
Good food and plants. I like plants. I grow a lot of plants.
I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And you're listening to Sustainable Futures. So what did you eat today, Ryan?
A muffin. I had a BLT sandwich. And I had a peanut butter and honey sandwich.
Oh, lovely.
And a scone.
Ah.
A lemon scone.
Well, that sounds really good, Ryan, because today
we're talking... A lot of bread products.
Yes, yes. Well, today we're talking about food, which is why I ask you what you ate today.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about buying local, buying at the farmer's market and the benefits of that. And then we're also talking about factory farming, or rather we're hearing an interview about factory farming mm-hmm. and diet and the benefits of eating a vegan diet. Now, Ryan, I'm not a vegan.
Me neither.
I'm not a vegetarian.
Me neither. Yeah.
I think that for a lot of people, eating meat is very ingrained in our culture. For mm-hmm. a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot
sometimes
of people.
Sometimes I bite my own fingers.
Oh, yikes. Not such a tasty meal. But I love the topic of food because we have such an obsession with food and mm-hmm. we love to eat. And I mean, look at the weight problems that exist in North mm-hmm. America. Not only North America, all over the world. I know that mm-hmm. there's a huge childhood obesity problem mm-hmm. coming up in Ireland and in England as well. There are more and more obese children there. And we'll just put anything into our mouths because it tastes good and we don't kind of think about what exactly we're putting into our mouths. And we need to start thinking about that. And a lot of people are really starting to emphasize reconnecting with food, where our food comes from, how it's made, all of that to increase sustainability.
And our correspondent, Stuart Richardson, had an interview with Carl Loskin of Co-op Radio's Animal Voices, and they talked about some of these issues.
With the annual celebration of Earth Day, more Canadians are thinking about their daily activities and their impact on this planet. We question our use of automobiles, the type of light bulbs we use. All these things are on the right track. However, what is missing is accountability from biggest polluters of greenhouse gases. One of those things that hardly ever enters the public discourse is the mass production of our food, most commonly called factory farming. Online, I have Carl Loskin. Carl is an expert on this subject. He produces a weekly show on Co-op Radio called Animal Voices, and he also does great work for Earth Safe Canada. Good morning, Carl. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Glad to be on your show.
Thank you very much. And let's get started. Our food distribution system that I referred to as factory farming is one item that most commonly is overlooked in the environmental debate. Many of us still have this idea that of the pristine family farm, and they don't really want to consider the conditions in which the food is produced, Carl. Can you paint a picture of where our food is produced and packaged? What does this place look like in reality?
What we really feel we want is we want family farms and not factory farms, and a sustainable method that takes into account the emissions of carbons and, of course, the enormous usage of hydrocarbons to produce our food, and all that can be altered.
What does our food production facilities look like in reality?
Because of climate change and a number of other things, and also the large-scale production of food, we've seen this hot houses, tomatoes being grown, areas where they probably shouldn't be. But the most polluting and hydrocarbon-consuming aspect of it is the factory farming of animals. And there again we have what Al Gore has done tremendous work in with his documentary Inconvenient Truth, but on the other hand he shared the Nobel Prize with another group, and the other group did a study on the high cost of to the environment of livestock production, and the people who shared Al Gore's Nobel Prize, they said that livestock production was responsible for more harmful carbon dioxide emissions than all the cars on planet Earth. And that is a phenomenal statement. And you know, it was a 400-page report that was done by and published by the United Nations Agricultural Organization. So it's very reputable, and it's one of the items that isn't being exposed there. It's what we call the other inconvenient truth.
Carl, I'm just wondering, of all the things we talk about and how to reduce greenhouse gases, why is it that factory farming, which is a massive producer of greenhouse gases, why is it that it never really reaches the public discourse?
I think that we have tremendous industries. You know, I saw it was in the Vancouver Sun recently. Wow, I've got it on my desk here somewhere, and it gave the statistics of how large the meat production is in Canada. I've got it right here. It says that the amount of beef industry contributes to the Canadian economy each year is $26 billion, and the pork industry $3.4 billion in addition to that. And it's enormously, when people hear that I'm a vegan, they always ask me, where do I get my proteins from? And that's because people have been so exposed to the idea that you need lots of protein. Yes, of course, we need proteins, but all the proteins are also in all the vegetables and foods we eat and grains and nuts. So, you know, I've been a vegetarian for some 30 years, and I'm not showing any signs of protein deficiency. And, when I look at other people who are heavy meat eaters, I'm seeing these people, and I'm saying, well, they are the victims of much of the media and the power of these organizations like the Pork Growers Association, the British Columbia or Canadian Cattle Growers Association, and they're supported with evidence by governments and subsidized by governments. And you know, that's it's a hard thing to take, because it's now leading to so much environmental destruction.
Carl, when people are on this heavy meat diet, or I guess fast food nation kind of diet, we know heart disease is the number one killer, but what are they exposing their bodies to when they eat this factory produced food?
We'll take just one animal, and that's the beef cow. And before they get slaughtered, they go to these feedlots, and they get implanted hormones, and they get fed a grain-rich diet. And these hormones assist in making them put on weight. I mean, that's logical. you want to have big fat cow and you get paid by the pound. So that maximizes profits. And that's the other issue here, is that an industry which is bent on maximizing profits rather than concerned about, you know, what is in there, what traces of antibiotics is actually in the food that we're consuming, in the meat we're consuming, and what percentage of fat that is, are they good fats? These, I've always considered them to be health hazards, because it's not only the antibiotics. You know, there was a study out some years ago that showed that a greater percentage of antibiotics was used on livestock, like on the chickens and on the animals, and mostly in factory farm conditions where they crowded in unhealthy conditions with bad air, ammonia, than what was being consumed by humans. So, you know, it's we're looking at the health hazards of the age of antibiotics being over, and we don't have a ready replacement. And my friend Howard Lyman always says that we're just one step away from an epidemic. You know, it's that catastrophic. And many of these viruses that expose themselves, the chicken flu, the different diseases that cows get, and is a contingency fund, Canadian federal fund of $4 billion to support the meat industry, the cattle industry, in case of disaster. So they're free enterprises, but on the other hand, we're seeing this support of industry, which is also a support of votes in rural areas. Seems to work together.
We know factory farming is kind of fuel intensive and creates a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, but what about water? In production of meat, how much water is used, and how much water is contaminated in that process?
Yeah, it takes about 1,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. So that's enormous. And I'm using one of the lowest figures that are being quoted. People consume quite a bit of water, and, you know, we might not think of it, but, you know, just to survive, we use about 24 gallons of, the average household, 24 gallons of water every day. The animals, you know, they get washed, they get dipped in, and all kinds of items which are tremendously water intensive. But even to grow corn, and this is one of the other problems, is that we're growing the corn to not only make biofuels, which is another subject, but we're growing this corn and feeding it to chickens. And then we're loading up these chickens with all kinds of chemicals and antibiotics, and then we're consuming it. And if we had to eat lower on the food chain, and that's what we're really advocating here, that it could make an enormous difference to the environment here.
Well, we've seen food riots all over the world with increasing prices of food. And I'm just wondering, how much of the corn that's grown is fed to humans in the world, and how much is fed to cattle?
I know it's some 80% of all the corn that's grown is fed to animals, especially the chickens, and some 89% of all the soya. United States is an enormous producer of the soya. It's fed to cows.
That's truly amazing to me. And now with this biofuel, we're going to turn corn into fuel. How do you feel about this?
Well, I think that's totally misguided, because, you know, I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. In fact, you know, Brazil has an example of a fairly positive use of creating energy, ethanol, methanol, and we should be producing methanol as a byproduct of our landfill sites. We should be using ethanol. Is reasonably environmental in Brazil. They use it from sugarcane. But to use corn to make ethanol is, to my mind, next to insane. We're looking at the aspect of even last year's figures of some 800 million people on planet Earth that suffer from hunger and malnutrition. And now that was before these price rises have come into an existence. And people, I believe in some countries like in Vietnam, they have vending machines. Was it you that told me about that?
No.
They have vending machines. You know, my friend told me that. I know who told me that yesterday. He says they have now vending machines in Vietnam, and you put your coins in there and you get your handful of rice. And that's because people cannot afford to buy the quantities of rice to sustain themselves. And it's such a valuable food, so widely consumed in so many so-called third world countries.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures, an interview with Carl Loskin.
It amazes me that we can be so wasteful with the resources we have in such a hungry world. Now, I wanted to touch on one of the buzzwords of the day is sustainability. A couple of years ago, we had a bird flu epidemic. And what caught me was, geez, how could the flu spread so quickly? And because 20 million chickens had to be destroyed, how could 20 million be infected so quickly? And then I realized 20 million birds were on about 14 farms. Did we learn anything from this? Because this cost us $100 million in tax subsidies. Did we learn anything from this episode?
Well, you know, I think that we're pursuing a more careful regimen in when workers move from one farm to another. And also, what you've just said highlights what I said just a little bit further a few minutes ago, is how the governments are supporting this industry. And there was an example of the only organic chicken farm that came down with the bird flu was a farm that had a factory farm with some 50,000 chickens on the other side of the road. So one really has to question here the intensity and density of how these animals are being kept in cages, not allowed to roam free, not able to express their natural instincts. And that's so sad.
These chickens are kept in horrendous conditions. And I always wonder if there's been any studies done on the quality, putting the humanity aside, the quality of the product that's being produce versus like an organic farm. Has there been any tests or studies done by Industry Canada on the conditions of these animals?
You know, I'm a gardener, and I know that if I have a healthy soil, I will produce a good, healthy plant. Well, the same applies to the animal. If the animal is getting a diverse range of healthy greens and being able to, and is, for one, a happy animal, I think that's an important component that's often missed, but also is getting a variety of nutrients. And you know, when animals scratch in the ground and they pick up something, a worm or something, it's getting a little bit of earth as well. It's getting a diverse. And whatever it is and what it produces has a total difference. And I know people say, I don't know of any studies, you ask me about that, which say, well, has it got more B vitamins or more C vitamins? But I always hear people say, you know, if they're eating eggs, they say, well, you know, ever since, I don't mind paying more for the free-range eggs. They taste so much better. And you know what? I'll tell you also that I believe they're better for you.
Absolutely. And Carl, as some research for this interview, I went out to the grocery store last night. I seen apples from New Zealand, salmon that was being processed and shipped from Japan, so we could have, imagine BC getting salmon from Japan. And I'm wondering about this globalization of our food and the amount of fuel it takes to ship products halfway around the world. Do you see this increasing? And what do you think's behind this kind of globalization of our food supply?
I think that we want to produce our food wherever it's cheapest to produce it. And so there was this gigantic thrust to produce food in China. And it's backfired. It's backfired because it's come to light that there's been unacceptable levels of heavy metals and items in there, and become a very, very skeptical of what globalization is putting to us, and that not always the cheapest good is the best item for us. I love the way in which in Vancouver we've done many things really right, and one of them is we have local farmers markets in the summer. So you can get direct from the farmers. There's no intermediary group that takes a cut off before it comes off. It's direct from the farmer to the consumer. And when it starts in about a month's time, it's just a tremendous movement that has caught hold, and it saves this long-distance transport. I was at the superstore yesterday, and they had these box loads of watermelons. Each watermelon weighed, I mean, my goodness, about 4 kilos, and the price was $5.99. Figure it out, you know.
You wonder what level of exploitation when they can ship a melon halfway around the world and still sell it for under $5. But one of the biggest concerns, touching on that, if you talk to people, they say, well, geez, I'm on a limited budget. I need to find affordable things. What can you recommend to people who are worried about affordability and they would love to do all the right things, but they're kind of worried about affordability? What alternatives are out there?
Well, I think the movement, if you know somebody who's has a space in the garden, and you say, and they may be neglecting it, they say, how would you like it if I grew some vegetables here, and whatever I grow here, you could have half, and I will tend to it. And you know, one of the most glorious legacies that anybody can leave is to plant a fruit tree. You know, apples might not, it's maybe a little bit moist here to grow apples, but you know, I'm looking at my plum tree here. It's a golden plum. It's a semi-dwarf. It's only about 12 feet high. I can reach all the plums. And you know, it gives me between 1,000 and 1,500 plums every year. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, one tree. So, if you plant a fruit tree and take care of it, and instead of planting an ornamental yew tree, you're leaving something which wildlife can feed on. It's good for you, and you might enjoy looking after a tree.
You know, Carl, just you bring back a fond memory. I have an apple tree in my backyard, and it produces thousands of apples that I can't eat, so I give them to all my neighbors in the food bank, and what was left the birds and the squirrels ate, so it's just an amazing resource out there. And I just don't really do anything to it. I don't spray it. It just rains, and okay, the fruit's naturally produced.
I always leave some for the birds. Never pick everything off the tree. Leave some for the birds.
Well, I found that out last winter. How can people get information about their choices, or is there any places they can go to, like, explore what resources are out there in the community?
Well, there's a local... the other aspect is, you know, not only if you know somebody, people can grow food on their patios. You know, it's grow herbs, and it's like it's fun to watch it grow. It's such a part of nature. You have some basil plants. You maybe have a rosemary plant. Oh, how nice to go and pick a twig of rosemary, and you have it in a pot. It keeps well, and every year it puts out great leaves. The other thing is these community gardens are a great idea, and from time to time people give up their little spots, put your name down on a list, and save the environment and save the transport. The other thing is that I think is also quite important is that we can grow foods that provide us with food during the winter. You know, in February, I have like my leek plants were putting out greens. My kale plants were putting out greens. And have ever since, I have such an abundance from maybe 10, 15 kale plants. They're like about 2-3 feet high. But it's all new growth. And as from last year, I left those plants in the winter. I dug up my beets in February. So I dug up from a patch 10 feet by 10 feet, I dug up 52 kilos of sunchokes, Jerusalem artichokes, and I grow them on a mound, like a berm. I mean, there's ways in which during the times when not too much grows, that you can still be reasonably independent.
That's amazing. And can you talk to some other community benefits when you go to the farmer's market or a community garden? What are some of the things that you're getting that you're not just getting from going to the local superstore or whatever?
Well, you know, I love corn. Corn on the cob, and I eat it raw. Don't cook it. And when it's come in fresh, and it takes so much space to grow corn. You get maybe 2 or 3 years of corn. But, you know, I love corn so much. I can eat a couple of... And so I buy that. The other thing is I grow squash, and I have a garden shed, and my buttercup squash grows up to the roof, and then it spreads itself over the roof of the shed, keeps the shed cool, and I harvest these squash. I love squash so much. I just don't grow enough of them, you know, so... I often buy from different right. types of squashes.
Now, I know a wonderful place people can get good information. It's a show called Animal Voices. Are you familiar with this show, and can you tell us about it?
Well, Co-op Radio is like your radio station presented by volunteers. It's non-commercial. We do a fundraiser twice a year, and we've been going for 9 years. We've been on air every Friday at noon.
Any final thoughts today on our impact to the environment and our food in general and how we can make the biggest impact?
Well, you know, we're not asking everybody. I think if everybody eats lighter on the food chain, they can make a gigantic difference to the environment. So they say that every person in North America, if they skipped one meal of chicken per week and substituted vegetables and grains, the carbon dioxide savings would be the same as taking more than 500,000 cars off the U.S. roads. That's a statistic I got from a very honorable source. So there's many things we can do. Eat lower on the food chain and eat it fresh.
Thanks again, Carl, for spending some time with us this morning.
That's great. Bye for now.
Up next, another Sustainable Futures correspondent, Anna Maria Cristina, speaks with Roberta LaGuaglia, the operations manager of the Vancouver Farmers Market, about the benefits of buying local and the community the farmers market brings together.
With the current food crisis and the consumer demand for organic and locally grown food, it is no wonder that Vancouver's farmers market is such a success. Having started in 1995 as a small market with one venue in East Vancouver, the Vancouver Farmers Market has expanded to 4 different locations, allowing for various community access. The Vancouver's Farmers Market aims to foster community health and local economic development through the creation of a venue where community members have greater access to safe, healthy, locally produced, environmentally friendly food, and where BC producers can market their goods directly to urban consumers. Roberta LaGuaglia, the operations manager of the Vancouver Farmers Market, is here to talk about community sustainability and the need for locally produced food. Thank you, Roberta, for joining me today. When the Vancouver Farmers Market started out, it only had one location, and there were many obstacles the organizers needed to overcome in order for the event to be successful. Can you describe how the market came to evolve into the successful venture it is now?
Well, it was through the work of a lot of volunteers and community members who supported the market right from day one. The first day that they opened, all of the vendors sold out. And the next week, they had double the number of farmers there. So the word spread very quickly that it was a successful opportunity for vendors and that it was something that they should really consider, something that Vancouver hadn't seen before. And it was just an opportune time to fill the niche. Since then, we've had troubles with bylaws in the city of Vancouver that don't allow for vending on private property. We've had some issues with zoning and the appropriateness of certain venues for a farmers market. And each time we come up to one of those challenges, we try to rally support, speak to our representatives at council or even local MLAs to help us to get the message through to the powers that be that it is important for the community. And it's an event that people are starting to realize that it's really a value to them, not just as a grocery store, but as a community gathering place and as a mechanism for social change and for building community.
Since it has four different locations, and as well as a winter market and an annual indoor holiday market, how are the different venues and communities different from one another?
Well, we really celebrate our different communities, and our Trout Lake Market is definitely our most established market. It is the one that began in 1995. It's a diverse community. It's definitely representative of the different ethnic groups in the neighborhoods. People come from other areas of Vancouver to that market because it was the only one for so long. But the locals in that neighborhood really grabbed onto it and really are proud of it. And so we do have a lot of the majority of the customers there come directly from that neighborhood or from East Van. And then we haven't always had an option in Kitsilano, but now that our Kitsilano market is open, some of those folks who used to come to Trout Lake are coming to our Kitsilano location on Sundays. Again, you're finding people there who had never been to a farmer's market before, who never went to Trout Lake before. So we're opening up a whole new element of community to them. And a lot of folks have mentioned to us in Kitsilano that this is like the Kitsilano that they knew before. It's like the old Kitsilano. They never been to a place that had the community feeling in Kitsilano. So we're happy to be able to bring that to that neighborhood. And then at our Riley Park Market, we're seeing a lot of, because it is a daytime weekday market, we see a lot of moms with babies and young kids, people coming from after school or from community center programming, people in the surrounding Main Street neighborhood that might be heading to work or coming back from work. And our West End community market is definitely fully focused on the West End. Not a lot of folks have cars in the West End, so it's an opportunity for an event in the West End that's for West Enders. That's what we get a lot of comments about, that they are really happy that there's an event for them. It's not just an event that brings thousands of people to the West End. It's actually for them. And so it's going to be a lot of students, a lot of seniors, surprisingly, in the West End, which we were not aware of right away that there would be senior community there, but there's a large senior community and they support us very well. And then there's lots of folks, double income folks, singles, a lot of condo dwellers, obviously, and renters. So people who have small fridges and small kitchens. So the prepared food products that we offer at the market are very popular there.
There's an obvious demand within Vancouver for healthy, locally grown food. So how does Vancouver's farmers market play a role within the community to meet these needs?
Well, we are seeing a trend towards more organic farmers coming to the market. We have been for many years sort of 50-50 with conventional and organic produce. But the majority of the new farmers that we're seeing come into farming and the majority that are joining us at the markets are organic. So I think that they're seeing that the demand is there. Definitely at the market, it is the prime thing that people are looking for is either organically grown or naturally grown. We offer the opportunity for people to talk to their farmer and find out how did they grow this. And if they're not certified organic, how do they use pesticides? How do they use fungicides? And so they can find out at what stage in the growth cycle of that plant was it sprayed? Was it before the fruit came onto the tree? Then people may feel better about using buying that product. We encourage our vendors to try out the methods that are more environmentally friendly. And I think just through the sharing of information between the farmers, conventional farmer that comes and maybe they've been using traditional methods for a long time, they see that the customers are asking, how do you grow your food? And they know that there are a certain number of organic farmers there who are doing it in an organic way. And they're starting to change their mind about how they can grow their food. And maybe they're taking a little bit of a hit on the production and the amount that they can produce. But they see that they might be able to get a better value for that product and that people are looking for it and searching it out. So we definitely encourage organic producers to come on. But we're not an organization that discludes people because they don't produce organically or they're not certified. So several farmers have chosen not to go down the certification route. And so they have the option of calling themselves naturally grown if they provide an affidavit as to how they produce their food.
Locally grown food is closely linked with sustainability. What other sustainable ventures does the market promote?
We promote through our community table opportunity at the market. We promote car sharing co-ops. We promote bike to market day. And so we have a bike events. And we, at our Kitsilano market, provide a bike valet so people can check their bike safely and feel confident that it'll be there when they get back, and provide a safe place to hold it. We're looking to lobby the park board for more bike racks at all of our locations so that people have that opportunity to bike to the market, and we're encouraging people to do that. We're working on a no plastic in the market policy right now with our vendors, so we're phasing out plastic carry bags. We sell our own reusable bags as well, as we sell our own produce bags as well. So we're hoping for a waste-free market. We've switched our own juice cups to a compostable option. We're switching to biodegradable garbage bags. We have a bike trailer for our staff to use to get ice from our donor of ice every week. So we're trying little by little, small steps, to be an example to our vendors and to the community that there's lots more that we can do, even though we are a carbon-friendly event in that we bring farmers to the city. You don't have to drive out to their farms hundreds of miles away. And we offer collectives so that six farms can come together in one stall instead of having all of them to drive six trucks to the market. But we know that we can do better too. So we're always encouraging our staff and our vendors to do better. And we try to set an example for that as well.
The market promotes events and festivals. How do these tie into the market's mandate?
Well, we create an event that is more than shopping. So we want it to be more than a trip to the supermarket. It should be a community gathering place, a place to stay and talk with your friends and meet your neighbors. And so that's what our events do. They bring people to the market who might not normally have come to the market. So our tomato festival offers, you know, tomato lovers opportunity to see hundreds of varieties of tomatoes and try some they might never have tried before, and to learn some facts about tomatoes. So it's an educational opportunity as well. And we just feel like the more we can keep people in the market, the longer they can enjoy themselves, the more they'll get to enjoy the event and meet their neighbors and have some lunch and grab some great food for home for dinner. And it's just a matter of exposing ourselves to different groups, people that might not have been interested in the market to grocery shop, but now will come for an educational opportunity or a place to bring their kids for something fun, or just a nice afternoon for the family. And we're adding events this year for the BC 150, which is BC's 150th anniversary. So we're celebrating BC's agricultural traditions. So we're doing demonstrations of butter churning and cow milking, or actually I think it's goat milking, some, you know, pottery, candle dipping, things like that that people and farms have done for centuries. So we're trying to add some new elements to make it an experience more than just a shopping trip.
The market has three types of vendors, farm vendors, prepared food vendors, and craft vendors. How do these vendors differ, and what criteria must vendors follow in order to get involved?
Farm vendors must grow or raise everything that they are selling. So that means that if they raise cattle, then they can sell at the market. They need to send someone who is involved in production to the market. That is the same for someone who grows corn or cherries or whatever. It needs to be a person involved in production at the market. And that's one of our major requirements, is that we bring the producer to the market so that customers can meet them. And they need to be knowledgeable about the production and the growing methods and all those things, those questions that a customer might ask. For prepared food people, it's similar. They need to be the person who bakes or makes what they're selling. And Generally, those are folks who don't have a storefront. We're not open to large retailers. And so it's usually these are micro businesses. People are starting out. They may start in their home kitchen making something like jam or cookies. And then they might graduate up into the back of a bakery when the bakery is closed, making their granola or their pesto or whatever. And then they might move on to their own production facility. And we like to offer the markets as an opportunity for them to test their product and build their business. And then craft vendors, they are sometimes our largest group because it's a very diversified group of people, anything from wood to textiles and painting and pottery and glass. So it's a wide range of products. And they enter through a craft jury that we have on an annual basis. And it's quite competitive. And we're only able to take a limited number of them. So people that apply there are assured, we assure the customer that it's high quality craft. It's not hobby craft. This is really serious art that people are creating. And that way we feel like it lends a certain amount of seriousness and stature to that part of our markets. And we think that craft is really an important part of supporting the community and the artists that live in Vancouver.
Is there a desire to expand further since there is an obvious interest from the community?
We have a strategic plan that we set out maybe 2 or 3 years ago. We had hoped our goal was to have 10 markets by 2010. What we're realizing is that our internal structure, our organizational structure needs to change or needs to grow before we can do that. We also want to focus on working with the city and the province and our Parks Board partners to make it more secure for farmers markets to happen. So we don't want to continue to expand on an unsteady base on something that's not secure yet. So we apply annually for permits at our Park Board sites and the same at our city sites. And what we would like is to have some assurance of a long-term lease or a long-term permit so that we don't have to be wondering every year whether we'll get the permit we need, whether we'll be pushed or moved by another event that needs our spot. We're working with the city and our partners now to make the markets more secure, to get more signage and more city backing behind the events before we go forward. But there's definitely, we have our eye on sites around the city, and the city is starting now to incorporate farmers markets into the plan of new developments. So down at Southeast False Creek with the Olympic Village, they're considering a farmer's market plaza there. And so they're building in water facilities and electricity facilities, things that we don't have right now in our community center parking lots or on our street that we're in the West End. So it's nice to see that building, and that's where we like to go before we go to the fifth, sixth, seventh venues. We know that our friends in Seattle who have 7 neighborhood markets, we spoke with them and they said exactly that they wished before they had expanded out of 4 markets that they had made sure that things were all sorted with their permitting and the structure of how they go forward and do business. So that's what we're hoping to do first. We've learned some lessons from them. Yeah.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure. This is Anna Christina speaking with Roberta LaGuaglia, who is the operations manager of the Vancouver's Farmers Market. For more information, please visit eatlocal.org or check out one of the 4 locations, Trout Lake, West End, Riley's Park, and Kitsilano.
While our correspondent, Anna Maria Christina, was at the Farmers Market this week, she also did our Streeters and asked people why they go to the Farmers Market and why they buy local.
So what brings you to the Vancouver Farmers Market?
Good food and plants. I like plants. I grow a lot of plants.
And how long have you been coming to the Vancouver Farmers Market?
Oh, I don't know. How long has this market been here? 5, 8 years, something like that? Long as I can remember anyways. Well, I think you get a variety of different things, from good food to crafts and plants. It's mostly organic stuff. It's always fresh. And it's also a very social place. I mean, I meet a lot of people that I know here and have a good time.
What brings you to the Vancouver Farmers Market?
Well, I actually don't usually get to come to this one because I usually work on Saturdays. So I'm happy to be able to come, and I try to buy local produce, and I find it's easier. I don't have to think as much when I come here because most of them are local, and the ones that aren't are from the Okanagan or the island. So it helps. It makes it easier.
What are the types of things that you usually buy when you come out here?
I usually buy the things that we normally would buy at the grocery store. So salad things, vegetables. At this time of year, I'm also looking at the potted plants that we were too lazy to get in the ground earlier. We have an apartment, so we do container gardening, and so they often will have starts in pots, and those are usually organically grown with no pesticides and things like that. So again, it's harder to find those things sometimes at the local hardware store or something. So I know that they've been started with no pesticides, and then I can continue that.
And how long have you been coming to Farmer's Market?
I started going to farmers markets with my parents as vendors on the island in Qualicum. My dad and stepmom make preserves as a home-based business. And so I was introduced to farmers markets and craft fairs at a very young age. And so I just feel sort of at home at them.
Have you ever thought of being a vendor yourself?
I have. I'm a teacher by trade, so I don't have a service that I can sell at a farmer's market, but I mean, having worked as a vendor, I do enjoy it, and I would definitely do it if I had the opportunity.
So we're here with Mama Nelly.
Hello.
You're a vendor here at the Vancouver Farmer's Market. How long have you been vending here?
This is actually my first year, probably about my seventh market with the Vancouver Farmer's Market Association, so it's really exciting to be here.
What made you decide to become a vendor?
It was actually an accident. This business came around as a result of me taking some salsa into work. And it was a good salsa to start, added a few different ingredients, and it became a great salsa. And people just started buying it. So it became a business, and I thought the farmers markets were a good place to start, learning about how to create a business and how to bring my product up from basic to advanced.
So how has the experience here at the farmers market helped your product grow?
Oh, immensely. Before I started at the farmers market, I was doing basically just delivery sales. So I would go from business to business where I had worked in the past and sold my salsa to people that I already knew. So sales have vastly increased since I started selling at the market. Lots of people really seem to like the product, and it's just kind of getting a name out there, which is really nice.
So what kind of salsas do you have?
Basically, one type of salsa at the moment. It's tomato-based salsa with four different heats, everything from mild all the way up to a really hot.
And which one is your favorite?
My favorite is called Not Hot, which is about a medium, but so far the market favorite tends to be Just Hot, which for most people is a very nice balance between heat and the nice flavorful vegetables.
Are you planning on trying to make some new salsas?
Yes, I'm actually planning on bringing in some new products, hopefully by the fall. Right now I am still working full-time as well as doing the markets, so I'm really just kind of focusing on making sure that we've got enough product to sell here. But by the fall we're hoping to have an additional two products to come in.
So what else is in the future for Mama Nelly?
Hopefully big things. I'm hoping to continue with the farmers markets. I sell at six different markets at the moment, including the four in Vancouver, so six other areas as well. And then hopefully I'll be able to quit my full-time job and eventually just do Mama Nelly's, which would be fantastic.
Obviously, farmers market has been helping you out.
Oh, very much so. Without the farmers markets, I think that the level of sales that I've reached now would have been impossible. I think that with the help of the farmers market, eventually I'll go into commercial sales, as well as continuing to sell to the public through the market. Also taught me a lot about sustainability and buying local, which is really nice as well.
So do you do that as well?
We're working on finding local producers who are able to supply throughout both the summer and winter. It's just taking some time because obviously you need to get to know the producers in the area. So hopefully by midsummer we'll have more of a relationship with some of the local people in the area.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you at the market.
And now for your environmental news update. The BC provincial government has some more ideas about how to reach its greenhouse gas reduction target by 2020. On Wednesday, the Climate Action Team, a provincial cabinet advisory group, presented the government with 31 very specific recommendations about how to meet its emission reduction target. The suggestions range from engaging BC residents in public discussions and symposiums to requiring all houses and buildings to have an energy efficiency rating similar to the ratings applied to electrical appliances. These recommendations will supplement the BC Climate Action Plan released in June. The goal of the Climate Action Plan is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 33% by 2020. The initiatives set out in the Action Plan outline how to meet three-quarters of this reduction. The recommendations made this week are meant to cover the remaining one-quarter of the 33% reduction. For more information, you can download a copy of the report at www.livesmartbc.ca. Public comments on the report will be accepted until Monday, October 6, 2008. and the future path of zero-emission, electric, low-speed vehicles is looking bright now that Transport Canada has paved the way for these vehicles to be sold and used throughout Canada. Because of a change to the definition of low-speed vehicles, these environmentally friendly vehicles can now be marketed for use in low-speed environments such as university campuses and resorts. In order for a vehicle to qualify as low-speed, they must be powered by an electric motor, produce no emissions, have four wheels, and drive at a maximum speed of 32 to 40 kilometers per hour. Despite being safer for the environment, low-speed vehicles are not safer for their occupants. Low-speed vehicles do not have to meet as many safety requirements as conventional vehicles such as cars, and are described by Transport Canada as having a substantially lower level of safety than cars. For this reason, Transport Canada recommends their use in controlled areas such as golf courses, resorts, and retirement communities. According to a number of studies, global warming will cause more and stronger allergic reactions. We are already starting to experience some of the effects of this trend. Studies show that climate change is creating longer allergy seasons and more potent allergens. Ragweed, for example, is the leading cause of fall hay fever. With a warming climate, ragweed is not only growing larger and creating more pollen, it is creating more allergenic pollen. The amount of tree pollen is also on the rise in Europe and North America. Birch trees in Europe are blooming earlier, and this is causing an earlier, as well as potentially longer, allergy season. But it isn't just pollen in the air that is predicted to cause allergy sufferers trouble. Warmer temperatures and higher levels of CO2 in our air will cause fungal spores to grow profusely in basements. These fungal spores are responsible for many allergic reactions. People allergic to bee stings aren't safe either. Yellow jackets and wasps are now found in areas they have never been in before, and this may be the cause of the 600% rise in severe stings in some areas of Alaska. In other research news this week, scientists are reporting that heavy tropical rain is increasing and is worse than previously predicted. The report published in the journal Science reviewed satellite recordings of tropical rainstorms since 1980. This review confirmed predictions made by computer models that heavy rainfall would increase due to global warming. In fact, it not only confirmed predictions, but also showed that rainfall was more extreme than predicted. The satellite data showed 2 to 3 times more heavy tropical rainstorms than predicted by the computer models. That's been your environmental news update for Friday, August the 8th.
So there we have it, this week's episode of Sustainable Futures on food.
Yummy.
Uh-huh.
I really liked today's episode, Ryan, because like I said earlier at the beginning of the show, we have an obsession with food. And we need to really start thinking about what we put in our mouths. It's not just, I'm hungry, I'm going to eat something. We need to think about what we're eating and where it comes from.
Maybe start eating when we're hungry only. You ever notice how many times people, at least I know how many times I do, eat just because of the time of day? Or I'm about to do a big task and I won't have a chance to eat later, but not because I'm hungry.
So I hope you enjoyed this week's episode.
And we are wishing you
a sustainable future.